Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 1069, Socialists for Trump and Hitler, subtitled The Assistance, Part 9, Walking the Snake in India. This is being recorded on April 16th of the year 2019. The title of the program is a continuation, obviously, of For the Record programs 1061 through 1068, in which I'm talking about the outright fascist, Nazi, and spook foundation of many of the, quote, socialists, unquote, who have come to the fore via our media and social media as the face of the Democratic Party. People like Bernie Sanders, in particular AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and others who have become lightning rods for Republican criticism and propaganda. As I have indicated, I think that people like AOC and Bernie Sanders have in fact been elevated to their positions of primacy by fascist elements and by elements of the intelligence community, the CIA in particular, and as we will see in the case of AOC, the underground, right, specifically to make them punching bags, to make them media propaganda fall guys or gals for the far right. Bear in mind in that context not only the Cambridge Analytica affair, but the fact that Brad Parscale, who is the campaign manager for Donald Trump in 2020, has reassembled the old Cambridge Analytica team. AOC has lived on social media and the internet, and her activities have undoubtedly come under deep and prolific scrutiny by the very forces, the very tech forces allied with Donald Trump in 2016 and once again in 2020. Now, I have not got time to go into everything that I have spoken about, obviously. In 8 one-hour shows, I've covered a lot of ground. But one of the major focal points has been a gentleman named Saikat, S-A-I-K-A-T, Chakrabarty, C-H-A-K-R-A-B-A-R-T-I. He is a Harvard-educated Bengali or Indian-American from Fort Worth, Texas. He has become a multimillionaire in Silicon Valley and Wall Street. And in 2016, he suddenly got religion and hooked up with Bernie Sanders. He is the driving force behind AOC. He was her campaign manager. He is her chief of staff. He founded both political action committees, Justice Democrats and Brand New Congress, which have bolstered AOC. AOC and Chakrabarty were on the board of Justice Democrats, and Justice Democrats and the other Chakrabarty-founded political action committee, Brand New Congress, contributed a little under $1 million to a political consultancy firm that was also founded by Saikat Chakrabarty. Critics have alleged that that was illegal. As far as I can tell, it was not illegal. It definitely is tacky, however, but that is beside the point. The point is that it is Saikat Chakrabarty who is the political driving engine behind AOC. And I would note that Chakrabarty's co-founder, Cenk Uygur, a Turkish-American, also with an Ivy League education. He is a graduate of the University of Pennsylvania. He has a history of denying the Turkish genocide against the Armenians in World War I. In the closing of For the Record program number 1068, I speculated about a post-World War II Bosean or Bosist underground. Subhas Chandra Bose was a prominent India Axis collaborator. He was so well placed. He had sufficient gravitas in the Axis pantheon that he was able to achieve face time with Adolf Hitler, Heinrich Himmler, Benito Mussolini, Emperor Hirohito of Japan, and the Prime Minister General Hideki Tojo of Japan. His European fighting forces, about which we will say more in a minute, were folded into the Waffen-SS during the closing phase of World War II. His most prominent and numerous combatant force, however, fought in Asia on behalf of the Japanese. It appears that Subhas Chandra Bose actually faked his death and went underground. And the Institute for Historical Review and their publication, the Journal of Historical Review, that is respectively the institution and the publication put out by the Nazi Liberty Lobby that has engaged in serious Holocaust revision. They too have promoted a revisionist historical line vis-a-vis Narendra Modi, that it was Modi and not Mahatma Gandhi who was responsible for India's freedom in the post-World War II period. I also speculated about a serpent's walk scenario in which Subhas Chandra Bose would be exemplary as representing the Axis as an anti-colonial liberation force in World War II. Well, to make a long story short, I had intended to move on from Sekhat Chakrabarty et al., but I have come across information that is, well, really spectacular, and that confirms my rumination in a very profound way. Noting about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, she represents the Parkchester section of the Bronx. Used to be a largely working class and lower middle class Jewish neighborhood. Now it is primarily Latino or Latina, a Latin neighborhood, and has a very large Indian population. I don't mean Native American, but Indian as in India. The Indian Americans, not Native Americans, but the Indian Americans are the second fastest growing ethnic group in this country. And as we looked at in many shows, there are some strong links between the Hindutva fascist right wing of the BJP, the RSS, and Narendra Modi, and people like Steve Bannon and some of Donald Trump's Indian business associates. It now turns out, again, Sekhat Chakrabarty has done social media appearances with T-shirts with the picture of Subhas Chandra Bose on them. If Sekhat Chakrabarty had been some sort of ignoramus or doofus, I would not necessarily view that as being of great significance, but he is not. He is highly educated and very intelligent, and when he is wearing a T-shirt with the likeness of a very prominent Axis collaborator, and yet he is the driving force behind the, quote, democratic socialist, unquote, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, that should give us pause to investigate. And investigate I have done. The Times of India of April 15th of 2015 will be our point of entry, an article by Subho Niyogi, N-I-Y-O-G-I, Subho, S-U-B-H-R-O. I am sure that I am butchering many of these, or perhaps all of these Indian pronunciations. However, the written descriptions will have the spellings. The name of this article, or the title of this article, PM Modi to personally, unquote, look into Mataji files. This is about Prime Minister Narendra Modi, whose BJP and whose regime is basically the political outgrowth of the Hindutva, that is to say Hindu nationalist fascist organization, the RSS. That is the organization that murdered Mahatma Gandhi. It was modeled on Mussolini's black shirts and had very strong links ideologically and operationally with European fascism. More about that in our next program. We have talked about that in a number of shows, including For the Record 992 and For the Record 1020. Now, the reference here to Congress is not the U.S. Senate and House of Representatives, but the Congress Party of India. That is the political party of Nehru and many others, and it is the primary political opposition to Modi's BJP. Modi met in Germany with a guy named Soraya, S-U-R-Y-A, Bose, who is Subhas Chandra Bose's grandnephew. He also is the son of Amianat Bose, who was very, very close to Subhas Chandra Bose. More about him later. And also, Soraya Bose, it lives in Germany where he has a software consultancy business in Hamburg and is president of the Indo-German Association, or the Deutsche Indische Gesellschaft, as it is known. Remember those. We're going to come back to them. Prime Minister Narendra Modi and Netaji Subhas Chandra Bose's grandnephew Soraya Bose in Berlin. Prime Minister Narendra Modi met Netaji Subhas Chandra Bose's grandnephew Soraya Bose in Berlin and promised to examine the request for declassification of all files related to events since Bose's death or disappearance in Taiwan on August 18th of 1945. Speaking to Times of India over phone from Hamburg on Tuesday, Soraya said he requested Modi to, quote, right a wrong that has been propagated by Congress, unquote, adding, again quoting, I urge the Prime Minister to release the classified files on Netaji. He was extremely positive and promised to personally look into the declassification of the Netaji documents. Skipping down. The meeting late on Monday between Modi and Soraya, who has a software consultancy business in Hamburg and is president of the Indo-German Association, remember that, lasted for over half an hour and is significant in the light of recent disclosures of the Nehru administration's surveillance on Netaji's kin. Soraya is the grandson of Netaji's elder brother, Sarat Chandra Bose, and the son of Amiya, A-M-I-Y-A, not Bose, who too was among those under watch. The disclosure that Nehru was surveilling, Nehru's administration was surveilling the descendants and the kin of Subhas Chandra Bose, has hit India something like a cross between Watergate and the Edward Snowden affair, and has served as a vehicle for discrediting, again, Congress. That is not the U.S. legislature, but the Indian Congress Party. And I suspect here what we're looking at is a dovetailing of the Hindutva fascism of Narendra Modi, the BJP, and the RSS, and what is indeed a Bosean or Bosist underground or legacy in India. Now, note Soraya Bose, the son of Amianat Bose. Note the fact that he is the president of the Indo-German Association. From the Hindu business line of July 17th of 2015 by Ragini Bhuyan, B-H-U-Y-A-N, legacy wrapped in a mystery. At Soraya Kumar Bose's simple but elegant home in Hamburg. You cannot miss the large black and white portrait of Netaji Subhas Chandra Bose, showing Netaji reading out of the proclamation of the provincial government of the Azad Hind Fauj in Singapore. The photo underlines a family legacy. Bose is the grandnephew of the man who led an armed movement against India's erstwhile British rulers. That armed movement was allied with Nazi Germany and ultimately became part of the Waffen-SS and Imperial Japan, fascist Japan during World War II. Listen to the legacy of the Indo-German Association, or the Indische Gesellschaft, or BIG. That is the largest bilateral organization in Germany with 27 branches. It, as a consultancy, it is involved with guiding Germans keen on working in the booming Indian tech sector. And that basically, tech is the background of Sekhat Chakrabarty. Listen to where that began and when. Skipping down. Bose, that's Soraya Kumar Bose. Bose is the president of the Hamburg chapter of the Deutsche Indische Gesellschaft, or BIG, the Indo-German association that promotes ties between the two countries. Quote, the BIG was set up on September 11th, 1942 by Subhas Chandra Bose at the Hotel Atlanta in Hamburg. That was also the occasion when Jana Gana Manya was first sung as the national anthem, Bose recounts, adding that the DIG today is the largest bilateral organization in Germany with 27 branches. As a consultant, he often guides Germans keen on working in the booming Indian IT sector. He is also a founding member of the German, he is also a founder slash member of the German Indian Roundtable, an informal gathering that seeks to further mutual business interests. This reminds me of the Karl Duisberg Gesellschaft, which was the vehicle for Mohammed Atta's entry into the U.S. It is obviously inevitably linked with the remarkable and deadly Bormann Capital Organization that presides over German business, and that I feel will be prove to be the dominant organization in world history. Listen to how Soraya Bose came to Germany. Back in the day, Netaji's stay in Germany had proved instrumental in shaping his struggle. Decades later, that legacy would play a pivotal role in shaping his grandnephew's career. Bose came to Germany on the advice of Alexander Werth, W-E-R-T-H, Netaji's German interpreter in the Indian Legion. One more time. Bose came to Germany on the advice of Alexander Werth, Netaji's German interpreter in the Indian Legion. So not only is Soraya Kumar Bose the head of the Indo-German Association, the largest bilateral organization in Germany, he also is a founder of the German Indian Roundtable. The Indo-German Association, or Deutsche Indische Gesellschaft, was founded in September of 1942 by Subhas Chandra Bose and is an ongoing operational commercial organization in Germany and India, and a link, a direct link with the Nazi / Subhas Chandra Bose Association. And Soraya Kumar Bose came to Germany at the invitation of Alexander Werth. Now, Alexander Werth, along with Soraya Kumar Bose and a guy named S. A. Ayer, co-authored a book with three editions, an English, a Japanese, and a German edition. It is called Beacon Across Asia, published by Orient Black Swan Limited in hardcover. And this book basically loves Subhas Chandra Bose and is part of the historical revisionism that basically makes Bose, not Mahatma Gandhi, to be the real liberator of India. From the preface to Beacon Across Asia, authored by the aforementioned Alexander Verth, the translator for Subhas Chandra Bose's Indian Legion, which became part of the Waffen SS, and Suraya Kumar Bose, who is head of the Indo-German Association. From the preface, this is the English edition of a trilingual biography of Subhas Chandra Bose, the German and Japanese editions being the other two. Its six parts deal with his experiences in India, Germany, and Japan, and have been co-authored by people who either worked with or were close associates of his during his stay in their respective countries. This book, again, basically has co-authored by people who either worked with or were close associates of Subhas Chandra Bose when he was in Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan during World War II. The aim of the biography is to place Subhas Chandra Bose in a correct historical perspective with regard to his much-publicized revolutionary activities and to provide an understanding of an extremely complex man, much maligned by Britain and greatly misunderstood by her allies. That is, the allies, basically. The U.S., the former Soviet Union, France, etc. Again, Subhas Chandra Bose had sufficient gravitas in the Axis to achieve not only network with, but get face time with Hitler, Himmler, Mussolini, the Emperor of Japan, and Tojo. Not a small individual, and this biography in English, German, and Japanese was authored by people who worked with and or were associates of Subhas Chandra Bose when he was in Nazi Germany or in Imperial Japan. S.K. Bose heads the Indo-German Association, which was founded by Subhas Chandra Bose himself in Germany in 1942 and has continued apace as the number one business association operating on behalf of Indo-German commercial relationships. About this individual, and again, if this seems far afoot, this is the fellow whose picture is on the T-shirt worn by Sekhat Chakrabarty. Again, from the Times of India of January 24th of 2016, Netaji Subhas Chandra Bose wanted ruthless dictatorship in India for 20 years, this by Manimugdha, Manimugdhas Sharma, Sharma. Recent allegations about a newly independent India under Pandit Jawaharlal Nehru snooping on the kin of Netaji Subhas Chandra Bose is what conspiracy theorists and spin doctors need to push their agenda. That Netaji was a greater patriot than Pandit Nehru. Skipping down. Netaji Bose, by the way, means great leader. Netaji Bose, by his own admission in his book Indian Struggle, believed India needed a political system that was a mix of fascism and communism, something he called Samyavad. That would be basically something from an economic standpoint that would fall into the fascist third position. Netaji Bose made a special trip to Rome in 1935 to present a copy of his book to Italian dictator Benito Mussolini, whom he greatly admired and whose ideals he would follow for the rest of his life. The point being, this guy was a doctrinaire fascist. He wasn't just an opportunist who took Britain's involvement in World War II as an opportunity to gain India's freedom. He was doctrinaire. Continuing. In a speech the same year in Singapore, Bose spoke about India needing a ruthless dictator for 20 years after liberation. The then Singapore Daily Sunday Express, now defunct, printed his speech where he said, quote, "So long as there is a third party, i.e. the British, these dissensions will not end. They will go on growing. They will disappear only when an iron dictator rules over India for 20 years. For a few years, at least, after the end of British rule in India, there must be a dictatorship. No other constitution can flourish in this country, and it is so to India's good that she shall be ruled by a dictator to begin with." I would note that Bose basically was the antithesis of Gandhi, who dressed in a homespun loincloth. He advocated that Indians spin their own cloth as a way of boycotting British colonial mandates that they buy all of their cloth from the UK. In 1938, at the 51st session of the Congress at Haripur, that's the Indian National Congress, Bose was the president. He organized for himself a grand ceremony that was no less than a victory march of a triumphant ancient India king, referring from Digvijaya, Digvijaya. He supposedly entered the venue in a chariot drawn by 51 bullocks, accompanied by 51 girls in saffron saris, after a two-hour procession through 51 gates that also had 51 brass bands playing. He would do similar shows in Southeast Asia when he came to the helm of the Indian National Army and Indian Independence League. The point being that Bose, again, was the antithesis of Gandhi. Now, of the surveillance of Subhas Chandra Bose's kin. This from the Ponds of India of April 12th of 2015. Papers reveal Jawaharlal Nehru's hand in snooping on Netaji Subhas Chandra Bose's kin. It reads in part, "Documents accessed by author Anuj Dhar for his book India's Biggest Cover-Up show that Nehru, in a letter dated November 26, 1957, to the then Foreign Secretary Subimal Dutt, B-U-T-T, sought to know what Bose's nephew, Amir, not Bose, that's the father of Saraya Kumar Bose, who co-authored the book with Alexander Werth, that was Bose's translator, the German translator for the Indian Legion, and the guy who brought S.K. Bose, Saraya K. Bose, to Germany to head up the Indo-German Association founded by Subhas Chandra Bose in 1942. Again, Subimal Dutt sought to know, Nehru basically, sought to know what Bose's nephew, Amianat Bose, was doing in Tokyo. Basically, Amianat Bose, very, very close to Subhas Chandra Bose, was in Tokyo, skipping down. Amia Bose, son of Subhas's brother Sarat Chandra Bose, was known to be close to Netaji. One of the things that we noted in our earlier in this series was that Subhas Chandra Bose had networked with the Black Dragon Society and Mitsuru Toyama, its head. I think it is interesting and very possibly significant that Amia Bose was in Japan, and given Subhas Chandra Bose's having faked his own death, and with there very obviously a Boseian or Bosist underground in India, the fact that Nehru was interested in surveilling Amianat Bose is interesting and, I suspect, significant. There is an article in the Institute for Historical Reviews publication, the journal of basically their publication Winter of 1982, Volume 3, Number 4, by a guy named Ranjan Bora, B-O-R-R-A, that basically maintains that it was Subhas Chandra Bose, not Gandhi, who was the main person responsible for India's independence, basically doing for Indian independence what the Institute for Historical Review is doing for the Holocaust. The article is titled Subhas Chandra Bose, the Indian National Army, and the War of India's Liberation. Now, this journalist, Ranjan Bora, as we spoke about at the end of our last program, has a CV that includes working for the Washington Times. The Washington Times is owned by the Unification Church, and we have in AFA program number 7 and in AFA program number 14 spoken of the Unification Church as a continuation of the Japanese patriotic and ultra-nationalist societies. In December of 1991, I interviewed Daniel Junis, and this is an excerpt from For the Record 970 about the connections between the Moon Organization and the Japanese patriotic and ultra-nationalist societies.
Now, Dan, we have just been talking about the Unification Church, and specifically we've been talking about some of the connections between the Unification Church and Japanese fascism, specifically Roichi Sasakawa and Yoshio Kadama. Of course, we have been commemorating here in this country the attack on Pearl Harbor, and I wonder if you could talk about some of the Japanese fascist connections to the Unification Church and perhaps place that in a context which would be relevant for the listening audience.
Well, Pearl Harbor Day is a pretty good place to start. On the day that the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, Yoshio Kodama formed an organization known as the Kodama Agency, which was a kind of a purchasing agent for the Naval Air Wing. And Admiral Yamamoto, as many of your listeners may know, was the great champion of air power, of naval air power in Japan.
Also the fellow who commanded the fleet that attacked Pearl Harbor.
Right, and the architect of the attack on Pearl Harbor. But he faced a very serious problem with the outbreak of war. There were very fierce inter-service rivalries in Japan and competition for raw materials, the strategic materials that they needed. And what the different services would do is they had an intelligence apparatus. They worked with these ultra-nationalist or secret societies who would provide them kind of intelligence services, and they would, you know, they had networks strung out all through throughout the Pacific and Southeast Asia. Now Yamamoto's problem was that he really didn't have very many friends on the right wing. And one of the reasons for that is Yamamoto thought it was a really pretty bad idea to get into a war with the United States. He had been to the United States. There's a very famous quote, which I will have to paraphrase, about, you know, anyone who has seen the oil fields of Texas and the auto plants of Detroit knows that, you know, we do not have the industrial power to win a war with the United States. But Yamamoto did have one very important friend on the right, and that was Ryoichi Sasakawa. Sasakawa was a very prominent fascist organizer in the 1930s, organized many of these ultra-nationalist societies.
Now, are we talking about the patriotic societies?
Patriotic societies, yes. And the patriotic societies had their beginnings went back to the late 19th century, to when Japan modernized. They were kind of the successor to the samurai. After the Meiji Restoration, the samurai were declassed, and so some of them began forming these ultra-nationalist societies. Sasakawa represented a younger generation of a leader of an ultra-nationalist society, and he was fascinated by the new technology of the airplane. And so he really, he sort of was a more modern version of the ultranationalist. And he had a private, militia and a fleet of airplanes. And in fact, in 1939, Sasakawa had flown one of his own planes to Italy to meet with Mussolini and to help arrange the Axis alliance.
In fact, Sasakawa has described Mussolini as his idol and has referred to himself as the world's richest fascist.
That's right. Yes, I think he referred to Mussolini at one point as the perfect fascist. And in this private militia that Sasakawa had, he had his own followers wear black shirts to emulate the black shirts of Mussolini. Well, we also know that 10 months before war broke out, Sasakawa was touring the South Pacific in a flying boat, and he wrote to Admiral Yamamoto. It's one of the ways that we know a little bit about this relationship that Yamamoto had. Now, by one account, when it was Sasakawa who asked Kodama to form this purchasing agency, basically, and Kodama looted China and Southeast Asia of strategic materials and gold and, you know, all kinds of valuables that were necessary for the naval air wing needed, but in the process he also enriched himself.
Now, Kodama founded this particular agency or front, which was used as a purchasing arm for the Japanese naval air wing on December 7th, 1941?
That's right. It was formed actually in Japan. The date was December 8th because of the international dateline. But that was the founding date for the Kodama Agency. It was the same day that just as the Japanese were attacking Pearl Harbor, he formed this agency.
And this, of course, was being used to finance the Japanese naval air arm, which was in action over Pearl Harbor at that
time.
Well,
yeah, I mean, I don't know if I would go that far. I mean, it was certainly procuring strategic materials at the naval air wing, and it was also making Kodama a very rich man in the process.
Mm-hmm.
He was able to hoard a great deal of the wealth that he looted from China and from these Southeast Asian nations. The East Asia Co-Prosperity Sphere, as the Japanese called it.
Right.
And after the war, he was able to use that hoard to finance his rise in post-war Japan. He became a very important power broker, what the Japanese call a kurumaku,
right.
Which is literally means black curtain. It comes from kabuki theater, and it's the behind-the-scenes fixer. The man who pulls the wires behind the stage.
We have just heard a description from Jim Hogan's book, Spooks, talking about Sasakawa and Kodama, and that specific term was used.
Right, and that is where, Kodama had a great deal of money, and he formed an alliance with U.S. intelligence and began undertaking assignments for G2, the military intelligence arm, and by 1958, Kodama was on the CIA payroll. And also in 1958, Kodama began his fateful relationship with the Lockheed Corporation, helping Lockheed sell their aircraft in Japan. And in the 1970s, Kodama was implicated in the Lockheed scandal, in which he was helping Lockheed to pay off Japanese politicians in Japan. You know, very big scandal, as many of you will recall. Now, one of the things that's interesting here is that the Kodama and Sasakawa had a very large stake still in the what they called the co-prosperity sphere during the Vietnam War, and the Vietnam War was actually very beneficial for the Japanese armaments industry and also for consumer industries, and it provided because the Japanese were kind of a strategic partner of the United States in East Asia. And the war was extremely beneficial to their economy. It really sort of, that was the stimulus that launched the Japanese economy to its sort of, you know, super economic power status today. Again, there's an interesting connection here with the air war. You go back to Sasakawa and Kodama and air power, and here was the United States fighting an air war once again in Southeast Asia.
It's also interesting, Dan, if I could interrupt for just a second, that one of the other people involved, along with Kadama in the Lockheed scandal, was General Minoru Genda, who had actually planned the air attack on Pearl Harbor.
Yeah, very interesting connection. And you see that there's, what you see is that there's really kind of a through line here. You know, we tend to think that, well, you know, the United States defeated Japan, and then Japan became a democracy, and there was this break with Japan's militaristic past. But in reality, some of these figures survived and profited from the U.S.-Japan alliance and championed the have been championing the rearmament of Japan.
And also, of course, have been involved with the Unification Church, which is the subject of your forthcoming book.
Right. Now, this is where, you know, this is why one of the reasons I'm making the point about the Vietnam War. The Moon actually had missionaries in the United States beginning in 1959. But they actually had a very small following in the United States. By 1969, there maybe were 120 to 150 converts in the United States. But in 1969, that is when the Unification Church began doing, explicitly doing political work in the United States. And what they were doing was organizing protests to support the war in Vietnam. This was an era not long after Nixon took office, and there were these large protests against the Vietnam War. And the Unification Church began taking the pro side of the Vietnam War, and then later went on to become a supporter of Richard Nixon's during Watergate and so forth, and his, you know, until the 1980s has accumulated a great deal of power. But this also gets us back to the ultranationalist societies, because the Moon Organization, here they were operating in the United States, and their organizational model is essentially the same as these secret societies that were operating in Japan in the 1930s.
Now, what you're saying is that in your opinion, because this is a working hypothesis that I had advanced and that the listening audience has heard, is that not only are there direct connecting links between the Japanese patriotic societies and the Unification Church, but that the Unification Church could actually be thought of as an analog or perhaps even an extension of the patriotic societies.
Well, yeah, there's a very important article. There's a historian of the modernization of Japan named E.H. Norman, and he wrote a study of the Dark Ocean Society, which was the prototypical ultranationalist society. And I had been studying the Unification Church for some time when I came across this article, and the parallels were really striking. The typical ultranationalist society was a small, tightly knit cadre revolving around a father figure. And it's important here to contrast it too with European style fascism, you know, Mussolini or Hitler style fascism, where there was an effort to build a mass party, and you had a large number of followers. In the in this Japanese model of fascism, the ultranationalist society is a tightly knit cadre that makes alliances with various powerful institutions, the bureaucracy, the military, and the large corporations, which benefited from Japanese imperialism. It was sort of the glue. E.H. Norman described it as the glue that held together the edifice of Japanese aggression.
Now, where can people get a hold of this E.H. Norman? Either, is it a book or is it an article?
It is an article, and you know, I don't have a reference right in front of me, but it was published in a magazine called the Pacific Affairs, I believe is the name of it. And there was an organization in the 30s and 40s called the Institute for Pacific Relations. And you can find an excerpt in it, actually, collection edited by called Imperial Japan 1800 to 1945, the Japan Reader, edited by John Livingston, Joe Moore, and Felicia Oldfather, and that's a very useful. It has excerpts from that article and several other useful articles. anyway, to get back to this, what we find in the 1980s, a lot of Moon's strategy becomes a lot clearer to us in the various kinds of organizations that they're involved in. And we see this same pattern. You have this cadre that is operating through various front organizations that's involved in different kinds of activities. And they have one organization, which has military scholars and retired military men and involves itself with military affairs. They have another front organization, which is reaching out to large, multinational corporations. They have other organizations which are involved in the electoral politics and the political system. So that even though Moon does not have a large number of followers, he doesn't have millions of converts or even hundreds of thousands of followers like Hitler had in his brown shirts. With this cadre, he's been able to sort of build this structure, which reaches into very many different parts of our society and societies all over the world.
He certainly has a lot of money too.
Well, that's always been the $64,000 question with Moon, is where does the money come from? And for a while they wanted you to believe that they raised it by having his followers sell flowers on the streets. Now, that is pretty lucrative. I mean, though, they work pretty hard and they do raise an awful lot of money. But nowadays Moon is spending $1 billion building an auto plant in the People's Republic of China, just to pick one, the largest project I can think of. And I just really have a hard time believing that they're raising all that money to build an auto plant by selling flowers. I mean, if that were possible, I think General Motors might have stumbled on it already. And I have come to the conclusion, it's kind of a complicated body of evidence that you have to look at, but I've really come to the conclusion that the most plausible explanation is that Moon is being funded by Japanese corporations, just as the old ultranationalist societies receive their funding from corporations. And the one corporation that I'm most interested in is Mitsubishi, particularly Mitsubishi Heavy Industries, which is the Japan's largest arms manufacturer.
Mitsubishi also was one of the four so-called zaibatsu, the giant family trusts, which were instrumental in helping to bring fascism to Japan in the 30s and 40s.
Right, and Mitsubishi in particular was always very much involved with government contracts and military spending. They were much more dependent on that kind of business than, say, the Mitsui family, which was a very old business family. Mitsubishi grew up with the modern Japanese state, was always very much involved in armaments. And it was Mitsubishi, of course, that produced the Japanese Zero, very famous aircraft from World War II.
Also very much involved with Pearl Harbor.
Right, and very much involved with Pearl Harbor. And this was, and going back to Admiral Yamamoto here, Yamamoto was very much concerned with the production timetable he used to visit the Mitsubishi factory, and he was always concerned about bottlenecks in production. And this, once again brings us to Sasakawa and Kodama and the whole procurement of materials, because this was obviously something that was very important for the Mitsubishi factories to have all the necessary metals and rubber and so forth that they needed to manufacture these airplanes. Now we jump, again, going back to the Moon Organization and jumping several decades ahead in time. We find this corporate outreach arm that I've mentioned is called the Global Economic Action Institute, and we find that Mitsubishi Heavy Industries is one of the corporate sponsors in that. And today, Mitsubishi Heavy Industries is far and away the largest defense contractor in Japan, so that when the Moon Organization takes a stand in Japan in favor of the rearmament of Japan, or they have taken a stand in the United States in favor of a defense buildup, which tends to rationalize a defense buildup in Japan as well, since the two countries are allied. This pro-military line that the Moon Organization takes benefits the Mitsubishi Corporation. I mean, there's a remarkable coincidence of interest here, we might say. And while that does not constitute proof that Mitsubishi is funding the Moon Organization, you'd have to say that you'd be surprised if they weren't. I mean, there's just because there is that coincidence of interest. And, you know, there's kind of a through line here. I mean, Mitsubishi was a very big shipbuilding company. Mm-hmm. Their shipbuilding business has fallen off. And that was something that Sasakawa was very much interested in promoting. He had a charitable organization called the Japan Shipbuilding Industry Foundation. So we can sort of look at Sasakawa's career at different points in history and see the same coincidence of interest between Sasakawa and the organizations that he has sponsored and the Mitsubishi Corporation.
Fascinating. Now, very quickly, Dan, can you tell us anything about the role of some of the moon-owned businesses? For example, this evening I have already alluded to, and we'll be talking about again, Paragon House Publishers. I know that for a while the Moon Organization virtually dominated. I don't know if they still do. The Gloucester, Massachusetts fishing industry. To what extent do some of these moon industries, such as Tong Il and others, contribute to the moon financial empire?
Well, what's interesting is that the financial analysts say that these businesses tend to be money losers, mm-hmm. not profit makers. And in fact, one of the big mysteries is where do they get their capital? Because there seems to be this, especially with the Korean businesses, there's this constant infusion of capital and they're not really making any money and no one really understands. And although sometimes people say, well, you know, that's how Moon funds the Washington Times. He's losing $30 or $35 million a year at the Washington Times. It's supposedly coming from these Korean businesses. Well, they're losing money. So also I think the newspapers are being subsidized. I would conjecture that the publishing businesses like Paragon House are also being subsidized. And are really more, you know, with Paragon House, like the Washington Times, is part of an effort to influence public opinion or, you know, to influence the world of ideas through publishing books.
Mm-hmm.
Paragon House is linked to Moon's scholarly operations, reaching out to scholars.
Mm-hmm.
The fishing industry, that's also been projected by some as being a money loser or not particularly profitable. Although they have provided some pretty serious competition. I know that there's been a lot of concern in the fishing industry of being undercut by the moon fishing businesses. That, incidentally, too, is the fishing business, going back to the ultranationalist societies, the fishing business is a very common cover for ultranationalist activity. So it's another example where the Moon Organization is following the pattern that the ultranationalist society set in the early part of the century.
Alrighty. I do one more quick question, Dan. Actually, we could probably go on for a considerable period of time. The Japanese wing of the Unification Church is heavily involved with, in fact, virtually represents Japan in the World Anti-Communist League.
That's right.
What can you tell us about that?
Well, that was the World Anti-Communist League, as some of your listeners may know, was originally sponsored primarily by Taiwan and also South Korea, but when the World Anti-Communist League was founded in 1967, Moon and Sasakawa and Kadama and other leaders on the Japanese right were instrumental in establishing the league, the Japanese League chapter. And to this day, that, you know, the Japanese chapter is essentially controlled by the Moon Organization and has been a very, the World Anti-Communist League which has a new name now. I think it's called the World League for Freedom and Democracy.
A misnomer if ever there was one.
Yeah, well, with the collapse of communism, I think they decided they needed a new image. But in any case, that has been kind of a meeting ground for the international right wing. So it's been a very important place for the Moon Organization to do business with other fascists and hardline anti-communists.
It should be noted what the very last sentence in the broadcast that I did in February of 86 was I speculated that the Moon Organization basically represented an extension of the Japanese Patriotic Society's functioning in the United States in conjunction with it.
Right. Well, you were on the mark, I would say.
That again from December of 1991, and with a writer from the Washington Times, writing for the Holocaust Revisionist Institute for the Nazi Liberty Lobby, quasi-Nazi Liberty Lobby. I think the historical revisionism of presenting Subhas Chandra Bose as the real liberator of India is worth examining. And I think there is indeed not only a Bosist or Bosian underground, but a serpent's walk-like historical revisionism underway. This concludes For the Record program number 1069, Socialists for Trump and Hitler, Part 9, being recorded on April 16th of the year 2019. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.